Coming up on this week's show, Half-Life receives a huge 25th anniversary update.
Mode 7 style scaling comes to the Mega Drive.
And we chat Interplay, Fallout and audio with Doug Rappaport.
And the Retro Hour podcast is brought to you each and every Friday with our incredible mates at Bitmap Books. Now, if you're Christmas shopping, maybe for yourself, have you seen The Art of the Box? This new book from them is a celebration of video game box art from the formative years of the Atari in the late 70s right up until the modern day with indie and AAA releases. We'll tell you more about that in just a bit, but have a look at that and the rest of their retro gaming collection at bitmapbooks.com. Hello and welcome to the Retro Hour podcast, episode number 405, your weekly dose of retro gaming and technology news with me, Dan Wood.
Me, Ravi Abbott.
And me, Joe Fox.
And a very warm welcome to the podcast. Of course, a show that every single Friday lives and breathes retro video games, brings you up to speed on all the big happenings in the world of retro from over the last 7 days. A little bit of a roundtable discussion in the first half of the show. And then the second half of the podcast is when we welcome on a veteran of the industry to tell us their story and talk about some of the games we grew up playing. And we've got an amazing guest for you this week, an interview that you just did, Ravi, and I know you were so hyped about this one.
Yeah, so this is it's a really interesting interview. It's with Doug Rappaport, and he basically worked on audio for video games, but a very specific area, which was he worked on voices and voiceovers. And, you know, he worked for some absolutely amazing companies, Interplay, Mattel, EA, Treyarch and Konami as well. So he kind of worked in that period where CD-ROMs just started coming out and, you know, games were really exploding. And that kind of acquisition of voice talent, getting people onto the games, but also editing it correctly, working out stuff like the sound effects, the atmosphere, you know, Fallout is a great game for that because you've got that whole 1940s feel as well. You've got voiceovers, pre-rendered graphics, but Star Trek Fleet Academy was one that he worked on as well, which was 5 CDs. So, you know, that had a lot of audio on there. And later on, it developed to the point that he was working on the Spider-Man game that had the original cast on there. So Tobey Maguire. And, you know, there's some absolutely amazing stories with this.
And Clay Fighter as well. I think that's definitely an underrated fighting series. And for me, it's always a game I like to play around Christmas time because obviously you've got, you know, Bad Mr. Frosty in there as well. So it feels a bit festive, that game.
Yeah, that's a bit different because he had to, you know, put the audio onto a cartridge, which is a lot differently from doing it on, you know, a PC as well, where you have to consider all the differences with sound cards, if people are listening to it on speakers and... you know, there's a lot of compression and stuff that happens with having to fit them on a cartridge.
Yeah, and we love doing the audio ones as well, don't we? You know, being kind of audio guys, we always enjoy doing those. So,
oh, for sure.
Our special guest, Doug Rappaport, he's coming up in around half an hour from now. Now, I can't believe that this is our final show of November. All right, guys, who's got the Christmas decks up yet? Anyone?
Not yet, but there's neighbours. Plenty of neighbours with their trees up, which I keep spotting as I walk down the drive and stuff like that.
I went back to my mum's at the weekend and pretty much all of her street has got like the Christmas decks up and all the flashing lights outside. No one on my street has yet. I'm not sure whether they're all just like, you know, Scrooges around here, but we generally leave it until, because my birthday is December 6th. So we normally leave it until after my birthday. That's kind of my rule, but I don't know about you guys. I'm starting to feel a bit festive though this time, a bit earlier than
I am a Scrooge as usual.
Yeah. Well, you've got to feel festive soon, Ravi, because you know it's coming up in less than a month from now. We're getting close to, there you go, this year's Christmas quiz. Now, we are going to be swapping things up a bit this year. Of course, regular listeners will know, I mean, if you've just joined the podcast recently, because we do know that people come in all the time, this is basically a bit of a retro tradition. The final show that we put out before Christmas, it's we've completely changed the format up and we put on our cheesy Christmas jumpers, get a few mince pies, a couple of drinks and basically... challenge each other to a battle of the retro wits, as it were, don't we?
Yeah, it's kind of just for fun, and we really enjoy it because it's a different episode to put out. But I always lose, and this time I decided, you know, I'm going to host the quiz, so there's no way that I can lose. I might lose, actually, if I put some really bad questions in that make no sense.
How are you feeling about this year then, Joe? Because me and you, basically, we've teamed up before, haven't we? And, you know, been on a team, but this year we're going head-to-head.
I'm a bit of an anomaly with the Christmas quiz. So how many have we done now? Six? Would this be
our seventh? This will be our seventh one. This will be maybe
our
eighth.
Our seventh one. I think I've won it twice.
Yeah.
I've won it on my own and I've won it with Dan. But then when I haven't won it, I think I've come last every time with Ravi.
Yeah, that's on my team.
I may have come second once when RMC won. So it'd be interesting.
That was close that year, wasn't it? I remember.
Yeah, but yeah. Paul and Ollie are going to be competing. So Paul and Ollie, who come on every year, sometimes they host.
Retro Gamer Magazine.
Yeah, sometimes they host, sometimes they compete. They're competing and they really know their stuff. But we won't reveal yet, but we are doing teams again this year. And I'm not with Dan. So anybody's game for the Retro Hour this year?
Well, bring out the Amiga questions.
I'd be happy with that. But yeah, that's basically the thing. We've got Paul and Ollie on a team, Joe, and Joe and I have had a bit of agreement. You know, we're not going to be on a team together. Instead, we're going to bring in kind of a special guest to hopefully kind of boost our teams up a little bit and go head to head. So I'll be interested to see how it goes this year. And I've already arranged someone who I think is going to be a bit of a secret weapon, but you know what?
Bring him on, Mum.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I chopped all your games.
I was going to say, yeah, that could be one of your questions.
That damn Sega.
So, it's always a bit of a giggle that is coming up. The last episode that we do before Christmas, that'll be in about a month from now. And of course, we do our best of 2023 as well episode. So only a couple of normal episodes left of the year. But I don't know about you guys. I always love this time of year when we get into the Christmas quiz and everything as well. So bring it on. We'll tell you more about that in the coming weeks. And of course, feel free to play along at home. We always get a load of people asking about it, don't we? And people listening on the drive back for Christmas. So it always feels really festive. So not long to wait until that. But of course, before that, we like to bring you up to speed on what's been happening in the world of retro gaming and technology from over the last 7 days. And this is something we kind of missed out on last week, but since then, I've seen this absolutely everywhere, that Half-Life, over the weekend, celebrated its 25th anniversary. And Valve have actually done some pretty big things for it.
I was trying to wrap my head around if this was like an official like release, like an official update, and it is, isn't it?
Yes.
It's come from Valve. I can't believe it's 25 years old. It's just such a stunning game. You know, it just looks so good. I think it's because of, I can't bring myself to believe that PC was so advanced back then.
Yeah, November 1998, that game came out, which kind of feels like about yesterday. But
And you know, it was a changing point for digital distribution as well. So like Steam, the only reason I got on Steam was Half-Life. And I think that pushed a lot of people to get into that model. And now you look at it and, yeah, it's one of the biggest platforms and everybody's getting digitally delivered games. But back then, Half-Life was like one of the main titles that kind of encouraged people to do that.
Steam started in 2003. So, I mean, it was a good 5 years after Half-Life came out. But you're right, that was kind of one of the instigators that people would go on there, you know, to kind of do a digital download of that game. But actually, that is one thing that kind of ties into this 25th anniversary now. They've actually released some stuff on Steam that was previously only on CD, including a couple of updates that were originally, there was one of them that they're calling a long-lost Half-Life DLC that was called Uplink, that was originally kind of a demo level that was given away on some magazine cover CDs back in the day. I've got a feeling they give it away on the PlayStation mag when it came out on the PS2 as well. But basically, they released this on February 12th of 1999, and even though they called this a demo of Half-Life, it was actually kind of alternate content because this was kind of set in an alternate universe and it was content that was kind of based on some of the cut scenes and cut levels from Half-Life, but it never actually made it into the full game.
Yeah, because there was like Blue Shift was an expansion as well, you know, where you'd experience it through another person's eyes. And there were kind of lots of different expansions, but good to see that this one's hit it. And I think, you know, this update is great because there's a huge store as well on Steam, like Steam Workshop, and there was a lot of mods. You know, Counter-Strike was a mod that came out of Half-Life. So hopefully with this update and, like, you know, bug fixes and stuff that they've done, they'll be able to have that workshop available and all of those kind of mods might get a new lease of life.
Another thing they put in here as well is a series called the Half-Life Further Data Discs. Now, these were basically some freebies they gave out in game shops back in 1999 that contained some additional multiplayer levels and also some kind of different, you know, additional maps and that kind of thing in there as well, that, again, have never really been available to download officially online. But they've restored these three multiplayer maps that they give out in these retail stores back in 99. And there's also four entirely new multiplayer maps they've put in there as well.
Yeah, Contamination, Pool Party, Disposal, and Rocket Frenzy, which all sound fantastic. Fortunately, it was free for one day. Yeah. The actual anniversary of it, which was last Monday. But fortunately, it is only 71 pence if you want to buy this, including the game. So it's not 71p for the DLC, it's 71p for this entire pack, which I'm assuming is, what, like 99 cents, a dollar or something.
I'd get it quick, though, because that expires on a Tuesday. So okay. You've got until November 28th if you want to get that.
And also on YouTube, they've just released a 25th anniversary doc as well. And that's like an hour long, and that's all free on YouTube, which is awesome.
Sweet.
Yeah, it's massive, really well-produced documentary with a lot of the original creators of Half-Life as well. So obviously, legendary game. And, you know, we've talked about it before on the podcast. It kind of felt like that's when FPS games kind of went narrative, isn't it? You know, really brought that story into first-person.
Yeah, it wasn't just kill everything.
Yeah.
Yeah, it definitely was a point where FPSs grew up a bit.
Sadly, no further to Half-Life 3, but, you know, we remain optimistic that one day. But this should tidy you over until then. So nice to see Valve giving it some love. Lots of DLC available now. And, of course, that one-hour anniversary documentary as well that I'll link up in the show notes if you want a bit of Half-Life action this weekend. Now, obviously, you were a Mega Drive kid back in the day, Joe. Were you ever jealous of mates who had Super Nintendos and you saw those Mode 7 graphics?
You know what? I'd love to say yeah. Be like, yeah, I really wanted Mode 7. I didn't know what it was until I was a teenager, or until at least like 12 maybe. But looking back, you know, there is something about the Mega Drive. But looking back, you know, Super Nintendo, it probably did have better graphics.
As an Amiga user, I wanted the Super Nintendo.
There you go.
Yeah, I was like Mode 7 all over that.
Well, for people who don't know what Mode 7 is, it's basically if you're playing games like, give me an example.
F-Zero.
Yeah, that's a good example.
Mario Kart.
Yeah, so basically, yeah. Mario Kart's a really good one as well. So
Space
you've got
Harrier.
It's basically those, when it allows a background layer to be rotated and scaled.
Yeah.
You know, so you get those effects, the wrapping effects, you know, the translation reflection effects as well. So basically, if you had played sort of like Mario Kart, the way it kind of wraps around, which was a very impressive effect, especially when it zoomed in and out as well. Mm-hmm. Is something that I know they did kind of bring that to the Mega Drive with the Mega CD.
Yeah.
If you had that, it could kind of do some kind of.
Yeah, there was a Batman Returns, the driving game.
That was
That on the Sega CD kind of had like, you know, faux Mode 7 graphics. Mm-hmm. But the reason we're talking about this is there is a game coming out for the Mega Drive, as they do, called Gears of Rage. Which, through the power of blast processing,
gotta be in there,
is bringing Mode 7 or pseudo Mode 7 style graphics to the Mega Drive. And there's no tomfoolery or trickery here. Apparently, this is all purely on original hardware, and it will be from original cartridge when it does eventually come out. And kind of to tell you what Gears of Rage is, I want to say it's a bit like Rock and Roll Racing for the Super Nintendo, but it's a top-down racing game, isn't it? More like Micro Machines, actually.
Yeah, Micro Machines, Skid Marks, a bit like that as well.
Yeah, Skid Marks. That's really good examples. But it has, you know, kind of scaling pseudo Mode 7 graphics where it zooms in and out depending how far away and how close.
You know, the effect reminds me of the original Grand Theft Auto. It's kind of a bit like that, isn't it?
Yeah, you know what? Yeah, and the detail of it isn't a million miles away from the original Grand Theft Auto. And it looks really fantastic, you know, and if they really have truly got this running on, you know, off cartridge and stuff like that, and, you know, no trickery, just pure blast processing, like they say, which I know is obviously the gimmick and everything. It does look really, really good. I was thrown off. I thought it was going to be a beat 'em up where you could get cars and stuff like that. But I think, you know, that was to grab your attention, which is really cool. And it's coming from Laserbit Games, who have done a couple of Mega Drive games in the past, but yeah, looking forward to this one.
Do you remember one called Hyper Zone that was kind of Mode 70.
Oh, I don't remember that one.
Like Space Harrier-ish.
Is that on the SNES, was it?
Yeah, the top and the bottom, yeah.
Yeah, which, I mean, these games are definitely, I must admit, I prefer the more kind of traditional, you know, looking out the window kind of races or behind the car. But I think that, you know, it does look cool, this effect. It looks a bit slower than I think you'd see on the Super Nintendo, but again, they're doing this all in software, and we've got to say this isn't a finished product at the moment. I mean, they've been working on this since around early 2022, so about 18 months, but apparently they've got some big announcements coming up soon. It looks like it might be near the finishing line as well, so yeah, very cool to see. I mean, you know, yeah. It's always nice when you get new games coming out like this. I've got to say, you know, there is kind of a bit of a mixed reaction looking through some of the comments, people saying, oh, it's, you know, it's kind of a bit slow and pixelated, nowhere near.
I think it's a certain look for a certain time, and some people, you know, they're not the biggest fans of it. Like, one thing was hand mode on the Amiga and hand mode games, and some people absolutely hated them, and I always kind of liked it a bit, you know. There's like stretch textures and stuff like that. Some people don't like it and some people love it. So yeah, I guess it's for a certain audience, but it's also got that nostalgia factor.
Yeah, I think as a tech demo as well, it's always cool when, you know, you finally get something that people said your console couldn't do back in the day, and you're like, ah, might have took me 30 years, but look, we've done it. So
the console wars are far from over then.
And back on. So yeah, looking forward to that. Gears of Rage, hopefully landing on a Mega Drive / Genesis with those scaling effects very soon. Now, you mentioned the Amiga there, Ravi, and there's been some big Amiga news this week that I know is probably a little bit niche, this one, but I thought we'd talk about it because I think it is quite a big milestone. What about the first ever web browser that you guys used back in the day? Do you remember what it was, with the first ever browser that got you on the web?
Mine was Netscape, but I think pre-Navigator.
Mine was probably just Internet Explorer, to be honest.
Yeah,
I can't remember. I think the first time I ever went on the internet was... you know, when you go on like a camping trip with school.
Yeah.
And we went to one. Kingswood, I think it was called. I can't remember where it was. You know, hours away, you know, when I was about 10 and you go stay for like 3 nights. And I remember we had like a computer session and we got shown what Google was. And then like the teacher wrote on the board, go find these things on Google. And I think it was just on Internet Explorer. And it was like, you had to find a picture of Papa Smurf.
That sounds so quaint these days.
Yeah. I think that was my first ever experience on the internet.
Kids are born with that knowledge now.
So,
to me, it was Netscape was the first one that I really used, you know, properly to go online. But before that, I mean, I did kind of mess around with some on the Amiga that came on magazine cover CDs, you know, kind of doing it offline. Before I was connected, which
wasn't there a Mosaic version for the Amiga as well?
Yeah, there was, called A Mosaic. I never used that, but I remember reading about it in magazines. I've got a feeling that was the first one that came out on the Amiga.
Yeah, because Netscape was also Mosaic Netscape. There was all lots of different versions, yeah.
And the Amiga had, you know, I think it had three main web browsers back then. There's one called AWeb, I remember. There's one called Voyager. And there's another one called iBrowz, which has kind of got the title now of being the champion of the classic Amiga browsers because...
I totally forgot about Voyager.
I used to like Voyager back in the day. I mean, that was quite a fully featured web browser for the Amiga. That must have been about 97, 98 that I used that. iBrowz always tended to be the one that most people kind of went to, though, because it was the most fully featured. And it had a bit of a development break. I remember them developing iBrowz until around 2002. And then they just completely, I've got a feeling a new team took it over eventually, but you couldn't buy it. They didn't do any new releases for about 10 years. But recently, in the last kind of 5-6 years or so, there's a new development team have took over it and they've just been full steam ahead. I think there's been about 4 or 5 updates to it this year alone, including a major revision number. Now, I've been trying to find out, you know, the exact release dates in the history log. From what I've seen, version 2.0 came out in 1997. But version 3.0 has just landed this week. So that is quite a gap between major releases.
For sure. And it's tough because, you know, there's lots of like niche operating systems still that have their own releases. But I think the reason you're focused on this one is because it's still being updated. Like there's two worlds in the Amiga. There's the classic and there's the... next generation ones, and I use the next generation, and There's Wayfarer, which is on Morphos, that has support for CSS and all of these modern things. Now, iBrowse has just got an experimental support for Flash, which is a format that is already kind of dead. And
it'll be real audio soon. They'll bake it.
Yeah, it's incredibly hard to kind of get these things going on a 68K Amigas. And I remember there's one called NetSurf as well, which is like an open source browser that was ported onto lots of different platforms, and that had support for CSS, cascading style sheets, but it was really, really hard on the resources. It wasn't that well developed, and I think it was still in beta. So,
I've used that's on Risk OS. I've used NetSurf, which kind of runs quite well on the Raspberry Pi. And I mean, you're right, there are lots of different kind of niche browsers for alternative operating systems and abandoned operating systems. You've got stuff like 10.4Fox.
Classic
PowerPC Max, which development stopped on that in 2021, but a new team have taken it over now, and it's called Interweb. And you've got Classzilla as well on Mac OS 9. There's that MyPal, which is a up-to-date web browser for Windows XP that is still in development as well.
And it's interesting because there's stuff like the SSL that needs to be updated for the connections, because as all this time's gone on, you know, security's got better on the internet, and this fixes that, which is pretty amazing that you can, you know, pick up these old machines and still browse. I think there was one point where, you know, people were making sites for the old school browsers and then making ones for the modern ones as well.
Well, that is one thing about this this iBrowse browser on the Amiga, which, as you said, then it can connect to pretty much, you know, all modern websites. They might not all look right on it because, like you said, that CSS functionality is not in there yet, although it is apparently in the works.
We'll also see. JavaScript as well.
JavaScript's in there, yeah. JavaScript 1.6 is in there.
But it would run really badly.
Yeah, it does. Yeah. I mean, I generally turn that off on my like Amiga 1200 because otherwise you're waiting like a minute for a page to open with JavaScript. But I remember one thing that iBrowse did back in the day. It was the first ever web browser that I used that had tabbed web browsing in there.
Ooh.
So, you know, rather than opening a new window, you have, you know, like now in Chrome, you have the tabs with all the different sites in next to each other. I remember iBrowse doing that back in like 98, 99. So it was very early to that. And actually, you know, for if a lot of people are like, you know, why on earth would you want to surf the web on an Amiga? But there are definitely legitimate uses for it, to go onto basically, you know, game download websites directly and download games to your machine, and Aminet to get public domain software. So I think in terms of doing stuff like that, it is quite useful. Now, I've got to say that the pricing of it, I've seen some people kind of complaining about. There is a sale on at the moment where you can get 30% off the price, but I've got a feeling if you buy it if you haven't got basically a previous license, it works out around $60.
Well, that is expensive.
It is, but then I think, you know, I've basically, I use this web browser for free for like, you know,
for a browser, I know it's updated and stuff, but that was a model that was gone with Netscape, actually.
But if you did pay for it, cause I mean, I registered version 2.5 about, you know, 6-7 years ago, and basically this is a free upgrade if you've already got that.
Oh, that's good.
A full registered version. So, I mean, if you have, basically, if you've paid for it once, you know.
Like legacy seems like, users.
Yeah, it's a lifetime kind of license, it feels like. But I just think, you know, it is awesome to see people still developing browsers for abandoned machines that, you know, the rest of the world would assume are kind of long
left. Yeah, I love it. Like, I've seen, you know, older machines that people have had, and they're suddenly like, oh, there's a browser on the homebrew store. Or there's, it kind of opens up the world a little bit more.
Yeah, and I mean, if you don't want to pay for it, there is a free 30-minute version that you can use. So you can download that and it will work, you know, if you just want to jump on and get stuff, which I imagine will probably be enough for most people. So, nice to see the iBrowse team jumping to a new major revision, version 3.0, landed this week. So I'll link that up if you want to check it out in the show notes. I think us guys are all, you know, quite into board games, aren't we?
Yeah.
Have you been to a board game cafe, Joe?
I have. I have a few times for friends' birthdays and stuff, and you know, Christmas time, obviously, you know, around the corner. A bit of a family tradition. Our family, we always buy a new board game at Christmas and drunkenly try to play it in the evening. And sometimes it ends
argue about the rules.
Yeah, argue about the rules or, you know, kick off at each other and stuff. But this one might grab my attention a little bit more than, a new version of Cluedo. This is a Sonic Roll that is coming out in, unfortunately, coming out in January 2024. So it is going to be missing that Christmas window. But this is coming from a board game company called Kess Entertainment. And they've not released too much about what the game is going to be other than some images. But the reason this is quite interesting is because of it's all the artwork and the game is all based on 90s Sonic, like original Sonic.
Mega Drive Sonic.
Yeah, Mega Drive Sonic, which is really cool because obviously most, you know, Sonic is huge. Sonic is, you know, he's massive these days because of the film and stuff and a lot of TV shows. And obviously some of the, you know, newer games have been quite praised. But yeah, this is the box artwork for it is kind of based on Sonic 3 imagery. And then from what we can see from the board game, from the board and the pieces, it looks quite complicated. There's a lot of dice and counters and Chaos Emeralds and stuff like that, but it's all like based on levels from the original three Sonic games, you know, Green Hill Zone's on there. And you can see all the bonus stage from Sonic 3 with the blue and red balls, which is really interesting. But all they've said so far is it's going to be a 4-player game where you can play cooperatively and you take control of Sonic, Knuckles, Tails, or Amy, and you have to take down Dr. Eggman, which still gives me quivers. It's Dr. Robotnik.
they look like they've done some before, though. So they've got Mega Man Adventures and they've also got Contra the board game.
Oh, that's cool.
Which looks interesting. Yeah.
That's pretty cool. And you know, it's cool to see this, you know, from a big kind of like big publisher. I know there was a Resident Evil board game that I really want to play, but it's expensive. It's like 50, 60 quid. So I've not had a chance to play this. But yeah, this looks pretty interesting and hopefully not too complicated, especially with it being Sonic. And I'm sure some children would love to have a play of this. I've just spotted it does say 14 plus on it, actually. So it might be a bit complicated for me.
Out of your brain power, Joe.
Yeah.
I remember me and Joe and our wives having a Monopoly session till about 4 o'clock in the morning once, didn't we? And then we had to give up. We looked at the clock, we're like, this is going to go on.
Many a times where we played, we had board game nights. You know what? You've just flooded memories back.
That's a test of friendship, Monopoly is.
Yeah.
If you don't end up killing each other.
Usually the girls who want to keep it going.
But this to me looks like, I mean, you mentioned board game cafes. It looks like the kind of game that would be very at home in a place like that. And I've got a feeling, I mean, obviously, I've noticed that the price of board games does seem to be kind of shooting up quite a lot, you know, whenever I see them new. I've got a feeling this doesn't look like it's going to be cheap because there's quite a lot in there.
No, probably not, no.
But yeah, experiencing it at a board game cafe could be the way to do it. But hopefully not too long to wait. I'm expecting that in January next year, so only a couple of months. So if you want to check out the pictures of that so far, I will put those in the show notes as well. I think we need a jingle for Boomer Shooter of the Week, don't we? Because it seems to be a bit of to get Ravi to sing one.
2 weeks on the trot.
Yeah, three, I think this might be now.
Oh, is it? Oh, my days.
But this one is a little bit different because, you know, obviously Boomer Shooters, we've mentioned this, we've kind of explained what they are every time. Basically old school FPS games, you know, kind of 90s.
I think the jingle should be me raging at the name Boomer Shooter. Boomer Shooter! There you go.
I'll just sample that. That's for next week. But this one is a bit different to the others because normally, I mean, the ones we've covered recently have been basically games for modern PCs that are designed with that retro FPS aesthetic, whereas this one is something that's been it's actually been around for a while, but it's finally getting a physical release, which is a big news. And this is a game that I'm not sure we've covered this one before, actually. It's called BioFury, and they're saying this is a Doom-inspired FPS for the 3DO.
It reminds me of a mix of Doom with a Chex Quest.
Right.
If you guys know that one. From PC around the same time, which was a Doom game, a Boomer Shooter based on Serial in America. But yeah, this is getting I didn't realize this was a game that had already been around, but yeah, it's getting a physical release to celebrate the 30th anniversary of the 3DO, which is
wow,
cool.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Yeah, that's crazy. And there's a couple of versions of this available, which do look, you know, really stunning. Limited to 100 copies is the nice big tall box version.
Like those original 3DO.
Like the original 3DOs,
The ones that don't fit on your shelves.
Yeah, they're probably already sold out, to be honest, but that was only, I say only, that was, I think it was $50 that one was.
Right.
And then there is the standard version, which just comes in, you know, a standard kind of CD jewel case for $30, and they are NTSC versions. I'm not too sure what region locking was like on the
radio. They've got a free digital version as well that you can download off GitHub and, you know, just try it out like a
kind of burn it to a disk yourself. Because yeah, 3 years got no copy protection. Yeah. But you're right, that is one thing they're saying. This is NTSC only, which if you've got, you know, most TVs can do NTSC and PAL just fine these days. It's only if you kind of hook it up to... you know, an old school kind of CRT, I guess, you know, television. It
might, do you have a 3DO, Dan?
Yeah. I had two at one stage. I've still got my, my 3DO got quite cheap. I got it from, you guys remember a shop in Nottingham called Playtime that we used to have. That was a great retro gaming store. I got it in around 2011 for £40 with two controllers.
Bargain.
Which they go for a lot more than that now, but... yeah, I mean, it's interesting to see that the 3DO actually just recently celebrated, like I said, Joe, the 30th birthday, October 4th, 93. It came out in North America. Over here, it came out on June the 11th, 1994. So next summer, it'll be 30 years old here. It's crazy, though, because I do remember reading a lot of hype around the 3DO when it came out, but never, I don't ever remember seeing one in person back then, or definitely didn't know anyone that had one.
Well, what do you think about these graphics? Because, you know, in the screenshots that I'm seeing, they're missing the floor and the roof.
Well, to me, that's one thing, yeah.
It's textured, but it's kind of got this kind of pre-rendered stop motion kind of, you know, like when they did Donkey Kong on the SNES kind of style.
Well, I will. There's a video as well that you can watch that I'll put in the show notes too. A lot of articles I've seen about this are calling it Doom-inspired, but to me it looks very much Wolfenstein 3D.
Doom. with those wall textures, definitely. Yeah. And the brickwork.
Yeah, so I mean, it looks much more kind of a, you know, a reskinned version of Wolfenstein. But obviously, you know, I imagine there's a bit more to it than that, but you've got stuff like, you know, zombies in there as well, you know, lots of different weapons, you know, exploding barrels, that kind of thing too. But it's definitely more in the vein of something like Wolfenstein as opposed to Doom, I'd say. But the thing about it is, I mean, FPS games have always kind of been a thing on the 3DO that people have wanted it to do better, because obviously it's got that, you know, infamously bad Doom port that Rebecca Heinemann had to do in like a, you know, a couple of weeks back in the day. So I think in terms of getting, you know, a good FPS, a new FPS game on the 3DO, it's definitely going to be something that community will appreciate. And the fact that they're giving it away for free on GitHub, there's 12 levels that you can play through. So, and you know, an actual story that unfolds as you go on.
Yeah, I like that kind of try before you buy.
Yeah. And then if you want that physical, that's going to be shipped on January 27th as well. So, yeah, I do think it looks pretty cool. You know, I've got to say, I've obviously seen, you know, more advanced FPS games, but I think the 3DO does seem to be a platform that doesn't get a lot of love. And this team that are behind it, I mean, there is, if you check out their YouTube channel, this is a team called Retro Love Letter. It might only be one guy actually working on these, but he's actually ported a few other titles to the 3DO recently as well. And he's currently working on a version of Tempest for the 3DO, which it basically looks very, very similar to Tempest 2000 on the Jaguar. In terms of, you know, those Jeff Minter style, you know, neon graphics and explosions and all that. So, yeah, I mean, it looks like in terms of homebrew 3DO developers, this Retro Love Letter studio does seem to be one to keep an eye on. And the fact that, you know, he uploads all the games for free on GitHub for people to try out as he progresses with them, I think is very cool. So nice to see the 3DO getting a bit of love. Might be time to get mine set up over Christmas and try a few of these out. So if you want to check that out, I'll link that up. And of course, everything else we talk about in our show notes at theretrohour.com. Now, before we chat to this week's special guest, going inside the world of Interplay, games like Fallout, Clay Fighter, Star Trek, and lots more as well, with Doug Rappaport. He's coming up in just a moment. Before we do that, let's take a moment to give a massive thank you to our longest-running sponsor, and this is our wonderful mates at Bitmap Books. You guys started Christmas shopping yet?
I have indeed.
Avoiding till the last minute.
I have. I've got most of my daughter's stuff. And I've bought some bits for my wife. You know what? I can say it because she never listens. I've bought some sandals, some lip balm sets, might buy some boots, but yeah.
Does she write you a list?
Yeah, she does, actually. She does, to be fair. And you know what?
We're so romantic, aren't we?
We are very romantic. I might do her a list and I might put some bitmap books on there.
Ah, there you go. Well, that's the thing.
Look at that.
Well, that is a great link, Joe. Because that's the thing, isn't it? I mean, I don't know if you're the same as me. My missus always says to me, well, write me a list what you want. I'm like, oh, I never know what to put on, you know? Yeah. Normally, if you want stuff during the year, you buy it. But this is a really good option. So if you're thinking of a good present for yourself, if your friends and family are asking you, this incredible book from Bitmap Books, our sponsor. It came out a couple of months ago, and it's one of the best I've seen from them yet. It's called The Art of the Box, and it is massive. Listen, like all their books, absolutely huge. You definitely get value for money with Bitmap Books. And this is a celebration of video game box art. Now, it goes from the pretty much the Atari days, right, you know, from the late 70s, right up until the modern day, features indie and AAA releases as well. And one thing we always know about Bitmap Books is their print quality and how the colours and the inks just leap off the page, don't they?
Yeah, absolutely. And what I also love about them as well is they're never too text heavy. They give you just enough about the game, you know, some of the details about the game, and just enough to kind of leave that lasting impression for you to be like, you know what, that looks fantastic, I'm going to go check it out, or something that you know used to play as a child, and just gives you that nostalgia and reminiscence of it as well. And it's just enough for somebody like myself.
And that's the thing about, you know, if you're talking about box art for games as well, it's something that is not as important anymore, you know, now that we kind of buy our games based on, you know, YouTube playthroughs and that kind of thing. But back in the day when you walked into, you know, like Electronics Boutique or Game Station or something like that, the box art of a video game, it could make or break it, couldn't it? A sale.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, if Golden Axe didn't jump off the page, you know, with the man and his little farm and stuff like that, you know, it meant so much, like, back then. Like, and these companies, they would hire these like fantastic artists to paint these huge pictures, and you know, it really had to sell it to you back then.
Yeah, and I mean,
those black Psygnosis boxes, I used to remember those.
Oh, yeah.
Beautiful. This is a real celebration of, you know, those days. So 464 full-colour pages presented in this gorgeous hardback book. You can hear it was really, really tough. Interviews and features with 26 video game box artists. Features over 350 artworks officially supplied as well. And it's a global book as well. So you've got, you know, artists from Europe, America, Japan as well, as all featured in here. So if you want a little trip back to those days when the art of the box was so important, you can check that out. And of course, support our sponsors. It really means a lot to us and helps the podcast out, and they're wonderful guys over at Bitmap Books. So maybe treat yourself for Christmas this year. Check out The Art of the Box and the rest of their collection at bitmapbooks.com. So with it being the final weekend of the month, that does mean coming up on Sunday, it is going to be Patrons Hangout weekend. I'm going to be rushing back from my village Christmas light switch on. So I'll be feeling all festive on Sunday evening. Hopefully not too much mulled wine beforehand, but it has been known on the hangout.
Is it going to be some like cheesy person turning the lights on? Maybe
it's usually Dan.
No, I'm not Dane Bowers or someone.
Well, actually, we did have Santa one year. The real Santa came along a couple of years ago. So, you know,
be Santa.
You're not convinced me.
The real Santa, yeah. So, yeah, I mean, it is going to be a really good one. Actually, the last Patrons Hangout that we do before the Christmas one. So, what is a Patrons Hangout, Joe, for people that haven't been on it before?
Oh, the Patrons Hangout.
Give us the sizzle. Like,
it's a virtual pub round the table. So we do it usually on the last Sunday of the month. And anybody who is a patron at any level is welcome. And we send a link out to everybody. And you can come on. And we literally just hang out and have a chat. It's usually about, 20 to 30 people on there, which is just amazing. And, you know, we've built a real community on there. And, you know, people keep coming back to it. We've been doing it, 3 years now?
Yeah.
Something like that. And, you know, I've said it before, I'll always say this, I've made some genuine friends on there. People who I've now met in person, you know, in real life, people who have traveled, you know, across countries and stuff like that, you know, for other events, but when we've met up at them.
Yeah.
And it's been absolutely fantastic. And this is all kind of built from, you know, not just the podcast, but the fans of the podcast have built this by coming on to the Patrons Hangout. And, you know, we don't just sit there and talk about us and talk about the podcast. We don't really talk about the podcast. We talk about anything, you know, that's been what we've all been playing, what we've been collecting. We quite often talk about films, just technology. Sometimes we help each other out, like, oh, can anybody recommend this or tell me about this?
We look at Gareth building his retro lair.
Yeah,
like
exactly. Yeah. You know, and you know, I'll usually end up, the joke is I usually end up spending a bit of money on something retro because somebody shows off something awesome or jogs my memory. But yeah, man, we do it for about 2 hours, 8 till 10 UK time. And yeah, it's just really fun to chill out, have a beer and just, you know, chat about stuff, you know, what we've been up to for the last month, really.
And like you said, we've got a great group of regulars on there, but we're always very welcoming to new people as well. We get new people coming on all the time. So, you know, don't feel like it's just kind of a, you know, a click. We always love welcoming in new members. And if you want to show us your den at home, your setup, your battle station, whatever you want to call it, that's always awesome as well. So we'd love to see you there if you want to join us for this weekend's hangout. A very good time to sign up to our Patreon right now. Make sure we can keep this podcast going into 2024 and beyond. And of course, we give you some extra perks as well. We try and get the podcast to patrons a bit early. You get it ad-free as well, and we're about to do an extra about 10-15 minutes of news stories just for our patrons in a second. So a very good time to sign up. All the details to join us on Patreon are at theretrohour.com. So thank you so much for checking out the news this week. There will be more on next Friday's podcast, and of course next we're going to go in depth into companies like Interplay, Treyarch as well, EA, Konami, and talking about games like the Fallout series, Clay Fighter, lots more as well, with our very special guest Ravi talks to Doug Rappaport next on the Retro Hour podcast.
So you're listening to the Retro Hour podcast, and we're here today with Doug Rappaport. And, you know, Doug's worked in some absolutely amazing companies, Interplay, Mattel, EA, and Konami as well. And we're going to talk about, you know, what it's like editing audio, but also voice in video games back in the days. And first, we've got a question that we ask all of our kind of podcast guests. And that's, what was your first experience of video games? The first game you played or remembered?
Oh, the first game I played. I had to be like Pong, which I guess was the first video game period, but as far as I remember. But I played a lot of Adventure, you know, that old...
Classic, yeah.
Yeah, I really love that. And Berserk.
So you had an Atari at home, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, nice. And were there any kind of game soundtracks that inspired you back then, even though it was a lot of blips and bloops?
As far as music, I can't really remember anything that sticks out from back in the day. But movies, yes, of course, but not with the video games. But playing a lot of Atari games and Space Invaders, of course, was another one. Asteroids, all the classic ones, really. But I really liked Adventure a lot.
Oh, yeah, Avenger was great. And you were a classically trained violinist and composer as well. That must taken a lot of work. And was this the kind of first focus of your career?
Yeah, absolutely. I started playing violin at the age of 9 and immediately had some aptitude for it. So much of my childhood was spent studying at conservatories and practicing, you know, 5 to 8 hours a day. Sort of took my childhood away a little bit because I was practicing so much. And in junior high and high school, I went to school just half a day so I could practice the other half of the day. I had a special schedule. So it was very intense childhood.
And it was all very classical focus. So you had that kind of inspiration from, some of the greats.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you also got into composition as well. That must have been a step up in, learning with music and kind of notation and stuff.
Yeah, my initial draw into composing was I was really interested in film and TV scoring, which is what eventually got me into video games later on. But I was really interested in being a film composer. So I listened to all the great film scores, you know, the John Williams and James Newton Howard, Hans Zimmer and Mark Kamen and all the old Mark Isham, Elmer Bernstein, all the film composers. Oh, of course, can't forget John Barry. He was a big favorite of mine as well.
And did this lead you to using any kind of digital audio editors or software or interfaces?
Yeah, I had a home studio with like an old Roland 1080 and a Yamaha. I forget what it was, the keyboard controller, but I think it was a Yamaha it's a Korg. I forget which one. And I had Pro Tools, of course, and I used mainly for composition. I used either Logic Audio or Digital Composer.
Yeah, I remember Logic. That was a really
Logic
powerful
main one I used.
Yeah, really powerful piece of software that was. And I guess you were using like MIDI interfaces.
Yeah. Digital Performer, that's the other one. Yeah, Digital Performer and Logic Audio. Digital Performer, I mainly used at work most of the time, and then like at Mattel, and then Logic Audio was what I used at home. And I did an album with a guy I went to school with, a progressive rock album, and we used Logic Audio for the whole. We recorded the whole album on Logic, except for the drums, which we recorded live. So it was a very robust program.
Did you have any kind of studio experience then? And, was it mainly making a home studio setting up, or did you ever go into any professional spaces?
Both. I used the home studio for, you know, to lay out the tracks and to get sort of like a rough demo of it. We recorded like vocals and guitar and violin and bass right into Logic and through the home studios. And then we went to the recording studio to record the drums and to mix and master.
So how did this lead to the video game world?
Yeah, so in early 90s, I got accepted into the USC film and TV scoring program in LA. It's a very small program. We usually have about 10 to 12 people only each year. And I got accepted to it. So I had already sort of quit violin by then. So this was like the news of my life to get accepted to it. So I moved to LA and I did the program. It's a 1-year graduate levels certificate program. And one of the guys I met in the program, who I did the album with later, when I was looking, after we graduated, while I was looking for film and TV jobs, he immediately went into video games instead. And he got a job at Interplay as sort of like a music supervisor. And so I was looking for film and TV jobs, and I had them here and there, but you know, they didn't really pay the bills. So I was sort of suffering a little bit in terms of paying my rent and everything. And he's like, why don't you come work at Interplay and be a dialogue editor and write music and do sound effects. And, you know, you'll have a steady salary. You won't have to worry jumping from one job to another in Hollywood, which is what I was doing, like I said. So I was like, yeah, sure. So I thought I was going to be going into Interplay just like for a year or two and then going back to film and TV. But I ended up staying in the video industry for 20 years. So 20 years later, I was in Paris working at a cloud gaming company as the vice president. And I was like, God, where do the years go? It's 20 years ago, I was at Interplay. And
how did that happen?
that happened. It was supposed to be like a temporary job, like a bridge job. But, you know, definitely paid the bills. And it was a lot of fun to, you know, a lot of, obviously, you probably heard it's a lot of hours, very intense.
Yeah.
Can be a lot of overtime. One company I worked at, actually, I won't mention the name of it. The overtime was so bad, the crunch time and stuff, that someone must have mentioned to the management that he didn't have time to do his laundry. And so rather than solve the problem of the overtime, the company told us to bring our laundry in and they would do our laundry. So they did our laundry while crunching the end of, end of the video game development. So that's
I can imagine it's even worse nowadays.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's when I knew that, like, wow, this is not right. You know, company's doing our laundry. There's something wrong here with the work-life balance.
Yeah, definitely. I was wondering, like, were you aware of how much video game music had progressed then? Because it was just as CD-ROM had hit and, you know, these giant FMV games were coming out that some of them had huge budgets.
Right. Yeah, definitely. Like, when I started at Interplay in the mid-90s, we were using film and TV composers. Some of it was done in-house, but a lot of the bigger stuff, like Star Trek, which I did there, Star Trek IV, I think, in Starfleet Academy. We used Ron Jones, who was from, you know, he did the Star Trek TV show. So we were able to get him to do the video game. And so we actually had live music that we recorded with an orchestra and we edited in Pro Tools and put into the games. So we, you know, we were really doing a lot of, you know, with the bigger titles, like I mentioned, we were doing real big scores.
I was going to ask about that because, like, capturing voices for games, a lot of the early ones were the ones that you worked on were quite basic. And then obviously the dialogue improved. What equipment were you using initially? And would you remotely capture the voices or would people come into the studio and record?
Both. With some remote work, there was a studio at Interplay. You know, our studios, we had our own equipment, you know, our offices. So we brought some people in, and then obviously for the bigger titles, we went to recording studios and recorded the video there where we were working with named talent like Ron Perlman or William Shatner or whoever. We went to an LA recording studio to record.
Well, one of the first titles you worked on was Max, Mechanized Assault and Exploration, which was one of these kind of strategy games. And I remember one of the first ones I heard was Command and Conquer that had, you know, your base has been completed, these kind of announcement voices. What was the approach to editing those, and how did you make it so it wasn't, you know, very repetitive?
Yeah, so for Max and another one we did around the same time, Shattered Steel, we did a lot of cockpit voices, and we recorded ourselves basically doing, you know, pilot dialogue. And then we EQ'd them to make them seem like they were, you know, coming through a walkie-talkie or, you know, something like that. And it made it really realistic in terms of once we put that into the game and, you know, we could hear these pilots talking and, you know, mayday, mayday, and all the other stuff that, you know, they said was really effective.
And those titles as well, you know, they kind of came on one CD-ROM. Obviously, later on, it expanded. But what was the kind of compression like and the quality? Because I guess you were aiming for, you know, people with just regular PC speakers at home or headphones.
Yeah, so we mixed it for different speakers. You know, mixed it for PC speakers, obviously, where, like you said, a lot of people would be listening to it. And then we mixed it for, you know, more professional speakers as well. So mastered it, rather. So we really took that into consideration with, you know, what, you know, with how the music and sound effects and voiceover would be downsampled. So we mixed it and mastered it with that in mind.
So you mentioned Starfleet Academy earlier, and that must have been a real step up and a huge undertaking because, you know, it had 5 CDs worth of space that needed filling.
Yeah, it had interactive music. So we actually created like a dialogue, sort of like a dialogue tree, but for the music, so that we had in a tree, in this music tree, so to speak, we could switch from a battle music to success music to death music to the next level, whatever it was, but it was interactive. So it wasn't just like playing one track for a major part of the game and then switching to another track. We had the ability to like really make a dialogue tree, so to speak, and switch the music from one emotion or one level to the next at the drop of a dime. So it was a lot of work to get that right, because there was so many possibilities where the music could go, but it turned out to be worth the time because it was really effective, I thought.
And stuff like that is kind of standard in games now, but back then, you know, implementing kind of incidental music and music that would change is a really kind of innovative thing to do.
I'm sure it's much different today and much easier, but we did it, you know, quote unquote, by hand back in the day, so.
And a lot of the footage was with the original cast, and the original cast recorded it. Did you get to meet any of them, and was there like a lot of excitement having the Star Trek crew kind of involved with the game?
I didn't get to meet any of them personally, but I cut a lot of their dialogue, edited a lot of the dialogue. But some of the guys I worked with, you know, got to meet, you know, William Shatner and, you know, some of the cast, and you probably know about the famous William Shatner recording,
yeah,
legend or whatever. Well, not really a legend. I can say it was true what happened. When I heard it, it was on the tape.
Did you want to quickly explain the Shatner incident for the listeners? That would be good.
Yeah, sure. So it was, one of my colleagues was directing Shatner, and they asked him to pronounce, I forget what the word was, something differently, which is normal process to, you know, take multiple takes and have something pronounced a different way or read a different way. So the voiceover director just asked him to pronounce a word a different way. And, he got really mad and he said, "Don't tell me how to do my job." And that became sort of, I think the recording got out somehow, you know, like if it was today, it would be a GIF or
like a viral TikTok or something.
Yeah. 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 Exactly. But back in the day, it somehow leaked and it went all over the place, and people would hear the recording of Shatter saying, "Don't tell me how to do my job." And it became sort of folklore, you know, as to whether it actually happened or not. But obviously it did. We had the recording and everything like that. But it was just, I mean, I'm sure he had good intentions. He was just frustrated with, you know, voiceover recording can be tedious and long and stuff like that. So we regretted that the recording got out, but it just became very legendary, that incident.
This is William Shatner, and I would like to invite you to take a journey with me into the 21st century. So take the next few minutes and listen very closely. You'll be amazed at what you hear. Okay?
Can there be a little more excitement in the beginning?
I love it. Okay. All right.
It sounded like really laid, you know, really super laid back.
Well, I'm saying, okay, I'll try and do that. Let's do take two. This is William Shatner, and I would like to invite you to take a journey with me into the 21st century. So take the next few minutes and listen very closely. Speak up. And maybe you better do it the way you hear it. Do it for me. No, I mean, just go ahead.
This is William Shatner, and I would like to invite you to take a journey with me into the 21st century. So take the next few minutes and listen very closely. You'll be amazed at what you hear.
Is that the way you'd like me to do it? Okay, ready. This is William Shatner, and I would like to invite you to take a journey with me into the 21st century. So take the next few minutes and listen very closely. You'll be amazed at what you hear. Okay, I think that came pretty close.
Are you making fun of me?
No, I believe that you'll ask that was about the way you did it. I wasn't jesting.
Okay. I'm sorry. I don't know.
I insist. Now, what I want you to do is is that satisfactory to you?
Maybe I should have just kept my mouth shut.
No, because if your mouth were open, you'd have popped some pills in them. So, do the next paragraph for me, page two.
Well, I don't know. I really don't want to, because I think you actually have a much better view.
No, I don't think I do. I would like to hear you read the second paragraph, so I can do it that way.
You know, now that I looked at the different things you did, I really like the first one.
No, I like it better the way you did.
Oh,
geez. Really, I mean it. Please, read, play, so I can get an idea of what you want. No, I'm going to do it the way you think it should go. No, I am going to do it the way you're reading it. Okay? I know you're here to see that I do it the way the company wants it, so I'm going to do it the way you read it.
Well, but I don't want you to do it.
But you're telling me how you want me to do it.
Well, I'm sorry.
No. I am going to do it your way. No, there's no apology necessary. You know what you want. You know what you want.
No, I don't. I mean, I really don't.
I mean, you come in here and you don't know what you want?
Well, I come in here because I know you're a professional. I mean, and you know how to do it. And I'm sorry I even said anything.
No, I am going to do it the way you want. Every paragraph. And you'll send it back to town and you'll see whether, I hope it will please everybody else. As long as I'm pleasing you, that's all that matters.
Mr. Shatner, would you please, I don't feel right about doing it, Tap. I really...
Well, no, you felt you wanted something done on the first paragraph. I'm trying to do what you want. Okay, let's lay down the second paragraph.
Because it was done in film as well, I guess there wasn't that many syncing issues with the video and stuff. It was just a compression of the quality that was needed to go on the PC. And there's stuff like, what were the considerations like, echo when you're in a certain room and in the scenes and stuff like background noises that were needed? And how did the team work together on that?
Well, we put it all together mostly in Pro Tools. And we had the ability to, like, one of the things I did when I was editing a voiceover was take the lip clicks out, like lip smacks. Some are very easy to hear and others are more subtle. That was my interview, actually, when I interviewed with Interplay, was they played some dialogue for me with and without the lip smacks, and I had to identify when I heard them to show that I had an ear and could hear it. And because that's obviously a big part of, back in the day at least, voice editing, making sure the dialogue was really clean. And then, we mixed and mastered it, with all the typical plugins in Pro Tools, and we mixed and mastered it depending upon what the, sample rate was going to be for that, for that game, and put in all the different effects that we needed to, like I mentioned, for like, Max or Shattered Steel, sort of the phone booths fungus reverb or lack thereof. And just to make, you know, we really did a lot of voice design to make sure, especially in some of the big games like Fallout, you know, really doing design work, you know, really creative design work, which is not only the sound design, but with the voiceover as well.
Well, I was going to say Fallout was kind of a huge step up in, say, like the multimedia experience. You know, before it felt like a film with interactive elements. You know, Fallout kind of brought everything together. What was your reaction when you first heard about this title?
Oh, I was super excited. It was a lot different than doing some of the older games like Dragon Dice or North by Northwest. And it was real. It was like much more epic. And, you know, the story was bigger. The cast was bigger. Just the ambition itself was bigger. So, you know, once we started working on, I remember a game I worked on called Normality.
Oh, that is such a good title as well. Normality. Yeah. That was a very, very innovative one.
Exactly.
Too.
Yeah. And that was one of the first ones I did that was very interactive. It was like doing a movie, or, you know, after doing Normality and then Fallout and Fallout 2. And we went from some basic stuff to much more technical and advanced sound design.
Well, I think, you know, Ink Spots maybe as the kind of theme tune. When you first heard they were going to use that and have this kind of nostalgic 1940s vibe running throughout it, did that kind of give you a lot of inspiration and make you think you could get more into, you know, like the older style of playing, more instrumental sounds?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the story dictated, and you know, when the story took place, or, you know, the background of the story really created our sort of sound canvas of what we could do and what we needed to do to create the environments and make it, you know, realistic and obviously sound good. And so, you know, yeah, I worked with some of the best sound designers and mixers back then, who, you know, our audio director, he got into film and TV after that. And but he had a great ear, and so he would master a lot of this stuff. And he actually mastered our album as well. But he was super talented. He was very famous in the industry and still is. So we had that level of perfection that we had to hit, you know, by his ears, which, you know, were miles and miles beyond ours. And so it was a real working on stuff under him, really striving for perfection and getting that perfect sound and these perfect environments for these games.
It's interesting because you have these kind of legendary producers in music, and then hearing that, you know, that started to come into video games, and now, you know, video game music soundtracks are huge. It's really interesting kind of a step up for video games there.
Yeah, and getting live, you know, songs by real bands and playing them into the games. Yeah, you know, that was definitely, you know, that was really cool too. Not just having scores, but, you know, having, you know, the big songs of the day in the video game as well. And that obviously, you know, created bigger budgets, like you said. So,
yeah. And you were a sound effects librarian as well. So you were kind of picking the sound effects. Were you ever doing any like folio or sound effect creation yourself? And where did you source the sound effects from?
Yeah, we had different sound effect libraries that we used. And then we used that as sound effects that we would then build upon with other, you know, layering and effects and everything like that to create the ultimate sound design, you know, from that. So, you know, we didn't just take stuff out of the libraries and put them right in the game. Obviously, we really designed them and used those as sort of the canvas and then built on top of that. And so I wasn't really involved in Foley or anything like that. Some other people did that. But just the regular, you know, the cutscenes and things like that where you're doing playing for. You know, we did it to the video footage and, you know, really tried to make it as accurate as we could.
They also had a lot of, like, rendered sequences, 3D sequences with people speaking in them as well. What was it like lip-syncing and kind of implementing that? And did you have to work with the 3D artist quite closely?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That was, the lip-syncing was definitely something that took time to get it right. You know, when it was off, it was very obviously off. So that was something that took a lot of meticulous work and a lot of time to make sure that the lip syncing was accurate. So,
well, I was listening to the Fallout 2 soundtrack, and that's absolutely amazing as well. And I feel there's a lot of effects in there as well that, you know, put you in the place, like the cable car sounds in San Francisco. Was it kind of a deliberate aim to have more atmospheric soundscapes in Fallout 2?
Oh, yeah. For those types of games like that, yeah, that's the perfect word, soundscapes, and creating the environment. And so not just having individual sound effects or voiceover just interdispersed, but really blending into the environment, and then obviously budding into the world of that video game.
And looking at the recent Fallout titles, they've still kind of taken that with them. And, you know, it's still got that exact same feel, really, for me.
Oh, yeah. That's important. I mean, it's just like a film. If you're creating a world, and you have to, you know, it has to, you know, it's not just the visuals, but the sound, the you know, the music, the sound effects, the voiceover, it all has to work, you know, keep people in the game. You know, we don't want something that sounds awful or that sounds wrong.
Well, what was the most enjoyable part of working on Fallout and the soundtracks for you?
Just getting to edit Ron Perlman's narration. So, you know, so it was just so good. So it was really exciting, because voiceover editing can be a little tedious and monotonous and occasionally boring. But when you're editing someone like Ron Perlman for a game like Fallout, it's like, it's just super cool. His voice is so just works so well. I assume it's sort of like, you know, when they recorded, what's his name, for Darth Vader in Star Wars, there's that same great voice that I'm sure excited the sound designers in Star Wars. Just working with him, was the same kind of feeling for me, like working with Ron Perlman on Fallout. It's sort of just great, the great sort of bassy voice that's just cool.
Yeah. And later on, you ended up kind of working on Clay Fighters is one, which is a cartridge title for the N64. And I was wondering what the difference was like going from, you know, a game with 5 CDs for Starfleet Academy to, you know, having to fit everything on a cartridge.
Yeah, everything was a learning experience, and figuring out what's going to sound good on that platform. Now, what sounds good on a PC or Mac is obviously different on an N64 or PSX. So we, you know, we really played with the downsampling and what the final audio was going to sound like to make sure it sounded good on all those different platforms.
I was wondering what the process of a talent acquisition and being a talent director was for video games. Like, how would you recruit people?
Oh, so when I was working at Konami, working on Karaoke Revolution, American Idol, that was back in the early days of American Idol when they had the original judges, Paula and Simon Cowell and Randy Jackson. And so, like, when I came to Konami, for instance, they had done an American Idol version with Simon and Randy, but they didn't have Paula, which to me was really weird. I mean, back in the day, I'll admit, I was an American Idol fan myself. So working on the video game was really cool. But as a fan of American Idol, I thought, like, you can't have 2 out of the 3 judges. That just doesn't seem right, you know, to be authentic to the American Idol audience and what they want to hear. You know, they want it to be as close to TV shows possible, obviously. So one of the things when I started Konami, I campaigned for, and I made it sort of my personal quest, was to get Paula Abdul into the game. And I was finally successful. It took a lot of, you know, back and forth with, you know, her manager and, you know, really working hard to get her, to acquire her. And then, of course, once we did, I directed her, for instance, in the studio. And when we're working with big talent like that, it's a great achievement to get them for the game, number one. And then number two, then working with them and getting the best performance possible from them. You know, just like you're working with any other actor, you want to get a great performance. So, but especially cool, you know, with the name talent and people that celebrities and so on and so forth, who, you know, the target audience would, you know, we're doing it for the target audience, obviously. So getting them all 3 judges, for instance, for American Idol was a big achievement, because we knew that's what the American Idol audience wanted.
It must have been, tough to kind of convince people that the video games are kind of as worthy as, you know, the TV show or...
Yeah, absolutely.
And yeah, like, getting them on board.
Messing with everything in the game. And so it's really, it was the final products of those things were really cool.
Well, another one with the original casting as well was you got involved with Treyarch and Spider-Man was an absolutely huge task.
Yeah, to McGuire, yeah.
Yeah, and you actually had the cast from the film doing the voiceovers as well.
So, yeah.
That must have been absolutely amazing.
Oh, totally. It's throughout my career, it's always been exciting to work with, you know, the real cast from things. And I remember I directed Tobin Bell from Saw for the Saw video game, from the horror franchise. And he was really cool, too. And it's like you see someone in a movie like that, and he's so evil and stuff like that, but you meet him in person, and they're the nicest people and such a great person to work with. And so over the years, you really find, you know, you have your favorites of people working with, and he was wonderful. He was really cool to work with. I think, with Spider-Man, with Tobey Maguire and Willem Dafoe, you know, everybody has their own personality, and sometimes personalities conflict in the studio. And like I said, with the William Shatner thing, but the end result is what's important.
I was going to wonder about the Spider-Man one, you know, it being so close to the movie as well.
Right.
Was there a lot of focus on keeping the dialogue accurate and kind of, you know, there'd obviously be sequel films coming out and stuff, you know, making sure the storyline was consistent with the Spider-Man world.
Yeah, it was really cool, actually, on Spider-Man, because a select group of us, only a small amount of people, were allowed to go and read the script, you know, before the movie was out or even finished, I think. And it was top secret to see the script. So, like, we had to go in, if I'm remembering correctly, like, a few at a time, and they wouldn't let us leave the room with the script. We had to read it right then and there, and they watched us. So we had the advanced knowledge of reading the script and seeing the, you know, getting an idea of what the movie was going to be like, you know, before, you know, working on the video game. And that, you know, having read the scripts, the script for it, you know, really informed us to, you know, to make a video game that would be an equal companion for the movie.
Well, then you mentioned, you know, Konami, you became a senior producer there as well. What kind of products were you working on?
So I was mostly working on the music games like Cherokee Revolution, American Idol, and all the sequels of it. I worked on Saw, like I said, that was at Konami. I worked on some other music games at Konami as well, similar to Rock Band. It's called Rock Revolution. You know, obviously it wasn't, it was Konami's version of Guitar Hero or whatever. And it wasn't quite a success, that particular title, but it was a lot of fun to make. And just working on all those music titles, and then Saw, and working on Saw too. Saw as well was really cool.
Yeah, I was going to say, because Saw, like, the game was really sound effects heavy.
Oh, yeah.
You know, with the atmosphere as well, and every aspect of it, like the dripping sounds and, you know, kind of everything. It must have been a lot of work to kind of create those soundscapes.
Oh, yeah. It was funny because we weren't the first publisher to get to work on that game. Another publisher had worked on it first, and believe it or not, from what I heard, they weren't even familiar with the Saw horror movies. So they got the IP to work on, but they didn't really know the IP. And so when they started working on it and they got the first portable slice of the game or what have you, they showed it to the movie studio and to the creators of Saw, and they were very unhappy because it didn't have sort of like the scariness and the gore and everything else that they knew Saw fans would want in the video game. So that it came to Konami after that. And as one of the producers of the game, I was familiar with the horror franchise. So were some other people who were working on the game. So we were able to make it more authentic and to deliver to the IP holders, you know, the studio and the Saw directors and writers, what they wanted, you know, because it's their legacy, obviously, and to have a video game as part of their movie world go along as a companion to it. They wanted the best, obviously, game possible. So we really worked hard to, you know, make the IP holders, you know, happy with it. So
Yeah, there's a lot of kind of tradition in video games to do something that's completely different from the movie and release it with, you know, the movie's name and kind of association.
Right.
And this seemed completely accurate to the Saw world.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that was a lot of fun.
I was wondering how much crossover there was with voice actors in the industry. So Jen Taylor, she was in Saw, and she'd also, you know, done the voice of Princess Peach in the previous Mario games, and Cortana in Halo. Were there like some regular voice actors that you would, you know, work on many different projects with?
Some, you know, that was the same too when I worked at Mattel, you know, working with some of the same actors who do the different doll voices and things like that. You know, I was working with some of the same actors reoccurring. And that's great when you can work with the same actor more than once, because you develop a relationship with them and you know each other's shorthand and you know how they work. And it's obviously makes for a better final result when you can have that history with the person and know how they work and know how to work with them and get the best possible results.
So out of all of the kind of titles you've worked on in the video game industry, what was your favorite experience?
Well, I'm a diehard NFL fan, so working on Madden was very exciting.
That must have been huge as well. Another massive franchise.
Yeah, working on that at EA, that was big for me. I mean, working on the movie games like Spider-Man, that was a lot of fun. Yeah, because like I said, I was sort of a film and TV composer wannabe, so film and TV was where I came from and from USC and everything. So having that, you know, video game movie crossover was especially meaningful to me, you know, doing that and Minority Report and other movie games like that and TV show games like American Idol. Yeah, those were all really cool experiences. And of course, working on something like Fallout was great. Anything was like where it involves so much creativity to really, make a good game. It's what we all want, obviously, what we're all striving for, and or make a great game, rather. But even, you know, the intense work at Starfleet Academy of doing that sort of music tree, the interactive music tree, it was so much work, but the payoff and having it work in the game and seeing how great it worked, those are nice successes to have, too. And they're not necessarily, you know, the most, you know, it doesn't make for a dramatic story or anything like that with a Hollywood actor or something like that. But to put in this certain amount of work, like we did with Spider-Man 2 as well, and then have the end result be as successful as it was, those are just great feelings when you work really hard and it pays off, you know. So,
but what would you say was the kind of average time you'd spend on a project? Because looking at something like, you know, GTA 6 that's coming up, I can imagine the dialogue in that is, you know, probably 100 times more than you were doing back then.
Yeah, I mean, when I was doing sound, you know, we were the last people on the next to the last people, us in QA, of course, that would get our hands on the game. And so we would be involved towards the later stages when we were putting sound in. But, you know, when I became a producer and I was working on the whole game, not just the sound, you know, those could run from a year, year and a half, not even 2 years for some, you know, being from development to shipping. Just depending, you know, games that, you know, have that are bigger and more epic, obviously. You know, like working on Superman Returns at EA, you know, that was obviously that has its own stories. That wasn't, you know, a great success, obviously, but a lot of work went into that and by that team, and they worked on it a long time. I remember that. So it got delayed and all the rest. So, but yeah, I mean, a lot, and Madden obviously is an annualized title. So we basically ship a Madden and then start working on the next one, you know, almost immediately. So those were obviously, you know, less than a year to put those out.
Well, nowadays you've left the crunch behind and you're a writer and, you know, you've put out some pretty awesome books as well. I can see, you know, you're on the number one Amazon's new releases for one of your titles as well. And they seem to be really popular. So can you tell our listeners about your books and how they can get hold of them?
Sure. So I've written 4 books, and the most recent one is called Dead People. It's a science fiction novel. It's sort of like dark comedy science fiction. And actually, currently working on a graphic novel of dead people with an artist who used to work with Marvel. So I'm real excited about that because it'll be a great transformation to have it in graphic novel format, you know, with the illustrations and everything else.
Totally.
And so, yeah, I've written three novels and a nonfiction book. Dead People, like I said, is my most recent one. And that's actually supposed to be book one of a series. And, you know, I work on the film and TV adaptations of these books as well. And so that's always exciting. And just getting them in different formats, like I mentioned, you know, the graphic novel of Dead People, which will hopefully come out not too long from now. But I have a website, StudlessRappaport.com, and all my books are on there. And you can read about them, and they link into Amazon and obviously to where you can purchase them.
Well, we love a bit of sci-fi and a bit of humor with it as well. And yeah, I'm seeing at the moment, you know, some people are quite saying it's got a bit of a Terry Pratchett vibe as well, which, you know, our listeners are very into. Yeah, which is great.
Yeah, I definitely wrote it with some dead people with some tongue in cheek. It's dark, but I hope it's funny. Funny dark.
Oh, yeah. The British, we love our dark humour as well. So, yeah. Well, Doug, it's been absolutely amazing to talk to you. And thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you for having me.